Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, January 20th, 2007. I'm Harley Schlanger. I will be your host today. On January 11th, just over a week ago, Lyndon LaRouche gave a webcast during which he said that we have a 90-day window of opportunity during which the new Congress must act to get rid of Vice President Dick Cheney, take action to end the Iraq War, and move toward placing the current financial system into bankruptcy reorganization. Quite a task, and obviously one that will take more than 100 hours, but Lynn said has to be done within 90 days. Now, thus far, 2 weeks into the session of the 110th Congress, we've seen some progress, especially in the feisty attitude among some of the Democrats in the Congress and among a number of Republicans who are jumping off the sinking ship USS Bush-Cheney. There were some very sharp collisions this week. For example, in Senate committees, there was a hearing in which there were very strong challenges to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, who defends giving the president dictatorial powers to this day. And there should be many, many more of these kinds of challenges and clashes coming up. However, as LaRouche emphasized during his webcast, and by the way, that webcast is available. You can hear it or read a transcript of it. Pick it up on LaRouchePub.com or LaRouchePack.com, I should say, LaRouchePack.com. But what LaRouche said is the real issue is leadership. Are there members of the House and Senate with the guts to stand up and stop Cheney's plans for a permanent war? And are there members who understand the deeper issue involved, what LaRouche calls a war for survival between our constitutional republic and what it's represented in history against the forces pushing the Anglo-Dutch neoliberal imperial model, the forces which are behind the Cheney war plan, the so-called surge, and the forces which are behind his willingness to sacrifice the general welfare of the American people to benefit the cartels of these Anglo-Dutch forces. So joining us today on the LaRouche Show to discuss this crisis and its deeper historical, economic, and cultural philosophical implications will be Jerry Rose from the National Executive Committee of LaRouche's organization and a panel of members of the LaRouche Youth Movement. Today we have Frank Mathis in Boston and Stephanie Nelson in Houston. So let me start with Jerry. Welcome to the LaRouche Show, Jerry.
Hi, Harley.
Well, let's start with the obvious fundamental question. What does LaRouche mean when he says our main adversary is Anglo-Dutch liberalism?
Well, it's just historic amnesia and illiteracy on the part of the history professors and what is taught as history, not to understand this as the most obvious thing in the world. When Lynn talks about Anglo-Dutch liberalism, our American creation of America, in a brilliant book by Graham Lowry called How the Nation Was Won, identifies that in very simple, undisputable terms, America was founded as a revolt against Anglo-Dutch liberalism in the most profound sense that could be. In other words, this clash, which has now come to the end of a system, it's very reminiscent of the end of Rome, very reminiscent of the 1348 to 1350 Black Death, which ended a certain phase of the Venetian Empire, that what you have playing out now is that this Anglo-Dutch liberal system is in its final death throes, okay? And the Cheney-Bush phenomena is a part of that system, whereas Cheney is not a thinker. Bush is not even literate, so he's not behind this, right? They're evil, they're stupid, they should be, starting with Cheney, and if Bush doesn't come along, they should be impeached. But why? Why should they be impeached? because they represent a British abomination upon the American system.
Well, Jerry, why isn't it good enough just to say we don't like these guys and we have to get rid of them? Why is it necessary to go into this deeper level of history?
Well, you know, it's interesting you should say that, because I had been thinking about that, and what's very clear to me is, you know, there's a very famous aphorism which you've heard before in your life. Many people have heard it. Those who do not study history are condemned to repeat it. And it's been attributed to many people. But most people don't understand what that means. And not only most people, I would say outside of the LaRouche movement, nobody really understands what that means. It's not that these stories are analogous to other stories in history and, you know, we could learn a lesson, a moral lesson from these stories. That is not what that means, even though it's often used in that circumstance, in that way. What it means very precisely is that after the fall of the Roman Empire, and we've had oligarchism since the beginning of Western civilization. It came to us through the cult of Apollo at Delphi and became the Persian model, which was an offshoot of the Babylonian model. Schiller and others have identified this clash in Greek civilization as Solon and Lycurgus. And this didn't die. Rome picked up this oligarchical model and imposed it upon the people of the whole Mediterranean through an imperial system. Rome didn't die exactly. It was overrun. But then there was the Western Roman Empire, right, and the Eastern Roman Empire. The West collapsed early. The Eastern Empire with Constantinople remained. And then you had a Byzantine Empire, but all oligarchical models. Then from the Byzantine Empire, the Venetians took over that empire and this model, right? Oligarchism, this model of men as beasts, men as chattel, denying the idea of the general welfare. Then from Venice, you had the Anglo-Dutch liberal model, right? And that, again, was Venice directly took over both the Netherlands and England in a very specific way, which I won't go through the details of because that's a two-hour class. But it's not, in other words, it's not that these are stories analogous to our situation. This oligarchical system, which created Cheney, which created Bush, which created Rohatyn, which created Train, which created these, what you call the undead. They're appendages of what's called the Fondi. And these Fondi, which are funds that really started really from the ancient Babylonians to today, right, with different transmogrifications, is what is killing civilization right now.
All right, Jerry, you mentioned some of these characteristics, but if we could just identify a couple of the leading hereditary characteristics,
sure,
which exist with the pre-Roman oligarchy through Rome, through Venice, through the...
Well, I could be very specific because I want to locate this question of Anglo-Dutch liberalism.
And this
right?
is important because people do need to get beyond just throwing out the general terms and actually understand these hereditary characteristics.
Right, because what you're dealing with, and this is very precise, let's take this Anglo-Dutch liberalism, which was what was left after the Venetian, in 1508, the Venetian mercantile oligarchical system, which was based upon looting and imperial looting of all of Eastern Europe and all of the East, which includes China, not so much India, but China and the Caucasus, Ukraine, other places, the Silk Road developments, right? Venice in 1509 was almost crushed. by all of Western Europe. They had been so venal and had angered so many of the different oligarchical factions. You see, oligarchical factions will kill each other, which is probably useful, right? They almost destroyed Venice. And at that point, the Venetians made a decision. It was called the famous Giovanni versus the Vecchi, the old houses, in which they made a decision that they could no longer militarily defend their mercantile looting of the East. They could no longer do it. And therefore, they had to make a decision to physically move their money, create new banking system, right? A new international banking system based upon gold bullion and silver bullion and the discrepancies between gold and silver. And they created in Amsterdam and then later in England a grouping of people who were directly involved in imposing this imperial model on England, and it, with great vengeance. You see, when we say Anglo-Dutch liberalism, it's very straightforward. In 1688, William of Orange, which was, it was the Dutch side of the thing, right, was created a revolution against the James II, who was the king, the lawful heir to the Charles I. It was Charles I, James II, right? He was overthrown by a grouping called the Whigs under Marlborough, which later is Winston Churchill's great-great-grandfather, the Marlboroughs, the Cavendishes, the whole a group of so-called Protestants, right? But they were Whigs, the Whig Party, overthrew the lawful succession of the throne and brought William and Mary, Mary being the daughter of James II, to the throne of England and overthrew the previous crown. One of the first acts of the Whig Party was to impose central banking. How did that work? You see, most people are idiots about gold and silver. They think, well, the face value, this is of the currency is what it's worth. They're insane on money. Lynn has made the point. What the actual, what's at stake is a view of money, which says that money is a good in and of itself, has an intrinsic value. And therefore, the value of money is what we can loot on the basis of these property titles, versus the idea of money or credit that was done early on by people like Cotton Mather and then later Benjamin Franklin, this idea of circulating money to circulate physical production.
So this was actually at the heart of the battle between the colonies and Great Britain or England in the period from 1763 to 1776.
If you read Graham's book, it couldn't be more precise, that the issue was they were going to loot the colonies of tobacco and other cash crops by unfair exchange rates, right, on their product. And they were going to loot it. Now, and they were going to withhold credit. And they were going to withhold any ability to expand into the interior of the United States, which Spotswood and Hunter and others who were part of a different faction wanted to say you needed a continental republic, right? And you had to move beyond. Because remember, we didn't have a king in the United States. The Puritan and Pilgrim groupings that founded the United States effectively were a republic. They did not have kings. They effectively had to pay obeisance to the English king, but they were not too thrilled about that anyway.
So the American Revolution then was a decisive break with this Anglo-Dutch system.
But literally, in other words, what people don't understand, it's just pure, it's not even amnesia, right? What it is they don't want to think of history as a continuity of a broad historic battle. And therefore, they don't understand the dynamics of the situation. No, there's no question. What I'm saying now is, and what Lynn says, Anglo-Dutch liberalism was William and Mary Anglo-Dutch seizing the crown of England and imposing looting, central bank looting. The way the central bank, the initial central bank of England got set up, which was called later the Bank of England, is that the Friends of Marlborough, Gandolphin, the whole Whig Party, bought the debt of England, just bought the war debt of England, because they got England into war immediately with France. It's a whole other story, right? And the debt, the war debt of England, was the basis to create a bank in which these so-called Whig grandees, these Whig financiers who were Venetian, who got their money through looting and certain Venetian operations inside England, that's how they got their money, set up the first central bank of England, called the Bank of England. Mm-hmm. And what they did was they...
Which was modeled on the Bank of Amsterdam.
Which was modeled on the Bank of Amsterdam, which basically picked up the war debt. What they did was they so-called lent money, right, and they were allowed to then issue bonds against the war debt. And then they would vote in Parliament to pay the bonds, okay, and they ran the Parliament. Okay, they didn't even lend that much money. They lent a certain initial amount, then they paid themselves off with interest, and they created a bank which was based upon taking the debt and ensuring that debt get paid before anything else.
And essentially,
they also did something which is not so well known. And they recoined all the money of England, which was silver, and they recoined it to gold. And Venice had the market on gold and set the price of gold vis-a-vis silver and sucked all the silver out of England, sent it to the East, got a better rate for the silver in the East. I'm talking about China and other places and the Persian areas and the Mongol areas and everything else. They sent it East, made a killing on the difference, which is what they bought for the gold, right? So they were making money all over the place. And it was basically a looting operation. The Whig grandees basically took over England to loot not just England but the colonies. It later be called the British East India Company and colonialization, right? Now, we Americans said when they attempted to impose imperial looting on the United States, our people actually went to paper money and other kinds of credit mechanisms to to defend ourselves against this oligarchical depredation. In other words, one of the hallmarks of Anglo-Dutch liberalism is setting up a central bank which actually runs the country. In other words, the king, William, did not run the country at that point. Now, he was a little pissed off about it. He fought. But the next three kings, the Hanoverian kings, George I, George II, George III, were brought in. George I didn't even speak English. So clearly he didn't run England, right? And they were just figureheads for war policies, for looting policies, run by the central bank.
And so
there was no idea of the general welfare, none.
And this model is the one which today we see in the Federal Reserve System, which is also a private central bank as opposed to a national bank, which is what the Founding Fathers brought in. You're listening to Jerry Rose on the LaRouche Show today. I want to give out a phone number for you to call to get copies of the webcast pamphlet from what Lyndon LaRouche said on January 11th. If you call, we'll send them out. The number to call is 800-929-7566. Let me double-check that. Yeah, that's the number for LaRouche PAC, which has produced these pamphlets, 800-929-7566. Jerry, I'm going to ask you another question, then I'm going to bring in our LIM panelists. Now, this model, then, we've seen fights in the United States, but this model has still continued to exist despite the existence of a contrary model in the American system, has it not?
Well, yes, and what you had with several times this system has broken down, and with it, the destruction of those populations which lived under it. We know the collapse of Rome, which was a slave system that had never, that was the worst, one of the worst slave systems in history. Over two-thirds of the population of Rome, of the Mediterranean, was killed by this system. Okay? Almost two-thirds. The relative potential population density dropped by almost two-thirds in the whole of the Mediterranean because this was a global Mediterranean system, right? Then, between Venice, the cumulative effect over the 500-600 years that Venice was a mercantile empire led to the Black Death of 1348-1350. And this globalized empire led to the wiping out of one-third of the total population in a two-year period of not just Western Europe, but pretty much of the whole Asia, right? This is where these systems lead. Now, what occurred is that because the United States was able to defeat the system in 1776 and then again by the 1783, and then a constitution which actually realized that you had to create a whole new set of arrangements, right, in order to make sure into perpetuity that the United States would survive this system, because it was killing everything. You know, in India, by 1820, 1830, the British East India Company had wiped out one-third of the population of India and made sure they couldn't produce any textiles, made sure that they produced opium, which they sent to China, right? And then they destroyed China with the opium and then grabbed the tea from China and tried to sell it to the United States. Now, that was the famous Boston Tea Party. It was the British East India Company selling tea to the United States, right, out of this imperial looting. Our founding fathers understood that this system was death, both morally and physically, right? And when I say morally, one of the critical elements of this system was a philosopher by the name of John Locke. John Locke was brought in with William and Mary on the boat that Mary sailed over on in 1688. Actually, 1689, she came a year later, right? John Locke was on that boat. He was in the Netherlands, and they brought him back because he was the Earl of Shaftesbury's court philosopher. The Earl of Shaftesbury was one of the critical Whigs that brought the Churchills and others into the Marlboroughs into power, right? It's part of the Whig Party, right? Which insisted that William come over, right? John Locke, what was his famous trinity? Life, liberty, property. That the reason that government is constituted by men is life, liberty, and the defense of their property. That men were not really human, and he said that. He said
slavery is a normal part of this oligarchical system, including with the founding of the United States.
Exactly. And in fact, it was Locke's writing of the South Carolina Constitution, which said life, liberty, and property, right? That humans, Africans, were property, and that the state had to defend that. It was from South Carolina that the slave system was brought into the United States under Locke's Constitution.
You might say lock, stock, and barrel. Right?
You might say that. In fact, you would.
to bring this up to date, and I want to bring Frank in a second, but to bring this up to date then, when you look at the policies of some of the people you identified, Felix Rowetten, George Shultz, and through their operatives like Dick Cheney, this is what they're asserting as their right again today, this right of an oligarchy to assert power over human cattle.
There's no question about it. But you see, they don't run it. And this is, we've got to be very clear on this thing. This is not their policy. They accrete to it. But this is the Anglo-Dutch liberal policy ensconced in Britain. And they want to see the United States destroyed as a nation state. Why are we in imperial war in Syria, or attempting imperial war in Iraq, attempting an imperial war in Iran? We're in an imperial war in Afghanistan. Why are we in it? That's not American policy. Step back for a second. Who has run the world that way? The British. And this is a British abomination we're getting off our back by impeaching Cheney.
Now, Frank, you're in the cradle of liberty, Boston, the Athens of the United States, where this battle was fought successfully at the time of the American Revolution. You're supposedly speaking with students at the elite universities there. To what extent, outside of our intervention, is anything that Jerry has just presented understood by the people going to colleges and universities there?
Not very much. Not very much at all. And we've had some recent incursions on certain campuses, Northeastern and some other places. We've been trying to get up our intervention into some of these universities as institutions, as educational institutions which have direct relationships to, you know, D.C., at Boston University, Harvard, the Kennedy School of Government, MIT. And what Jerry was bringing up is not understood at all. It's not that it's not very well understood, but it's not understood. But the interesting thing that you do have in Boston is you have people who hereditarily do have this thing in them, this Americanism, this rejection of the Anglo-Dutch liberal system. And I know one way that we've been able to capitalize on it in the recent period, especially after November 7th, and then leading through our intervention into the sort of the inception of the new Congress, is to really accentuate the education around the rejection of the hereditary figures, the hereditary concepts of the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, as Jerry was bringing up, right? One of the bases of the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, and one of the things we've run up here in Boston, is the rejection of ideas. The Anglo-Dutch liberal system hates ideas. Anytime there's an idea that's planted into a society that can actually develop that society and reject this concept of human chattel, this is when they react the most, specifically when they react the most against against Socrates, specifically in Plato in Athens, against the Renaissance, right, against the American Revolution. So one thing we've been focusing on up here in Boston, something that has a huge relationship to the education program that Mr. LaRouche put forward, is how do you get human beings, once again, especially in America, how do you get them to recrudesce, to bring back up, to conjure up that in them which actually is American?
Frank, we're going to have to pick that up on the other side of the station break. I would point out that Boston and Harvard is also where you have Kissinger, Samuel Huntington, and some of these leading British ideologues. So you're listening to The LaRouche Show. It's live on the web every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you can't hear it live, you can pick it up on the LaRouchePub.com website, where you can scroll down on the left-hand side to where it says The LaRouche Show. And we have a full archive of all the shows we've done over the years. Jerry has done several very fascinating shows in the past, and you could go back and find them if you'd like to. Now, it's also essential that this 90-day period will depend on activity behind Lyndon LaRouche's leadership and the leadership of the new generation of leaders, the LaRouche Youth Movement. And to be part of that, call the LaRouche PAC number and order copies of the webcast pamphlet to get out to people, to bring them into this dialogue. That number is 800-929-7566. 800, so it's toll-free, 800-929-7566. And you'll be able to go into your neighborhood as a modern-day Paul Revere and tell them we're out to defeat this Anglo-Dutch policy. Also, we'll take emails today. You can email questions to us at radio@laRouchePub.com. We'll pick those up after the break. So this is the LaRouche Show. We're coming back now. Frank, you were saying something about how to bring out the spirit, the true American spirit, in people who otherwise live in a pretty degenerate culture. I mean, I was on a radio show today, and someone said, does LaRouche really think this is a dark age? And I said, what other kind of society would people be discussing the battle between Rosie O'Donnell and Donald Trump? So, Frank, how do you mobilize to get people back to their true American roots?
Well, as of recent, we've been using something which is still, in a certain sense, it has a certain mysterious air to it. We've been mobilizing a lot around the music work, around attempting to relive the development and discoveries of classical musical composition and modes of communication. I mean, as an example, we've found in general that whenever you sing with either a quartet, quintet, or especially a big group, an entire chorus, whenever you sing in any given area, that transforms the entire area. It acts as a singularity generator. And you have people more open, more human, for whatever reasons maybe unbeknownst to them. And they're a lot more willing to dialogue on things that they should be speaking about in the first place. The political situation, the economic circumstances, and various other things. But we've also been bringing people into that process to sort of live through it on their own, bringing people into the chorus rehearsals that we've been running, and also the Kepler work, which has been very, very, very integral in terms of understanding something that Jerry brought up earlier around this the dynamics concept, which is a very debated concept nowadays. But I know that's one of the main focuses we're trying to figure out, is how do you sharpen up our capacity to communicate ideas? The only way you can introduce a new idea into a language culture is to raise that entire language culture up to that idea.
So Bach, in a sense, is part of that American culture in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's hear from Stephanie Nelson, who's here in Houston, Texas, which sometimes people think of Texas as its own republic. Stephanie, what do you think? How are things going in terms of getting across these ideas that Lyndon LaRouche discussed in his webcast last week?
Well, I think despite popular opinion, there is a lot of reason to have hope in Texas, even for Democrats. And it has a lot to do with the LaRouche Youth Movement. We're trying to recruit young people into a political and intellectual leadership group. But my generation has been so steeped, pretty much unconsciously, in existentialism and in an ahistorical outlook. And so that's just very dangerous, to just have a whole generation just kind of hanging out with no connection to what came before them, not knowing where they're going. So being able to situate a political briefing or a discussion that we're having, whether, you know, it's LaRouche's idea about retooling the auto industry or the financial system collapsing or why Newton is taught in their physics class and not Kepler, to be able to situate all these things in a higher context, higher historical idea, that's necessary since we want people in the population, we need citizens to act in a higher historical way. And I was just thinking during the discussion that the most recent example of this being successful was in San Antonio, where we very specifically communicated, because there was a runoff election in mid-December, there was a lot of assessment and commentary on it in the EIR. But I was there personally, so I can just say something about it. So back in early December, we went to San Antonio to help out in a runoff election to get rid of Bonilla, the incumbent Republican, and to have another Democrat in the House of Representatives. And given what took place on November 7th, LaRouche called it the new politics. So it was a higher idea than just simply that the Democrats won an election, and that was significant that a 12-year, you know, Republican domination changed. But so what we wanted to do in San Antonio was continue the November 7th election in this new politics drive in changing the population there, getting them out to vote. And when we were speaking in front of a lot of college classrooms, that's what we were discussing, specifically LaRouche's idea of the new politics and the higher concept of how our generation today is going to have to act to take up political leadership and stop being irrelevant to history or to politics today.
A major part of that new politics, then, is what Jerry was discussing at the very beginning, that if you're historically illiterate and suffering from amnesia,
right,
you don't understand how you got here or where you could possibly be going. So that's what you were taking up in the deployment. That's what the LaRouche Youth Movement took up nationally.
Right. And saying this to college kids, a lot of people who think they're educated or spending a lot of time reading and catching up on their education, it can be kind of confrontational to say that they don't know the real history of the United States or they don't really know these ideas. But to be able to lay it out, because only in situating where we are in the highest context, which would be this fight between the American system and Anglo-Dutch liberalism, that you get people to act in the highest way.
Well, Jerry, from what you're seeing from your perch there at the National Center, and clearly there is a change. How much has to be done, though, to move it to this next level? What's the plan?
Well, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I think the most dramatic development is that there's no way that Cheney, who represents, you see, it's very critical that people understand, you know, Cheney has to go. There's no question about it, because he represents everything that the American system is not. Okay, everything. You name it. On torture, on rendition, on eavesdropping, on imperial policy. We're not an imperial nation. We're not designed to be. In fact, you know, Lynn said, look, Americans would never be fascist, would never be imperialist, right? This is British, right? And in fact, we know it's British because Lynn Cheney, who really runs Dick Cheney, has direct connections to Baroness Simmons and this whole Whig Anglo-Dutch liberal crowd around Blair and others who have determined this policy. The policy is you cannot have nation states defending their sovereignty and their ability to generate credit for production. And therefore, America itself must destroy itself. Because, you know, as Lynn has often pointed out, by the time of the Civil War, when we had defeated the South and defeated any plans to balkanize the United States, there had to be a plan of internal subversion to make sure that the United States did not fulfill its destiny in making like itself all over Europe, all over Asia, as was going on in the 1904-1905 period. And after the Civil War, there was an explosion of American system countries. Germany was one. Japan was another. There were several others. China was going in that direction. This is what we were looking at the end of the Civil War and the follow on with the defeat of the balkanization of the United States. The reality of the situation is they had to get us to destroy ourselves from the inside. And then when Franklin Roosevelt came along and destroyed the British operations, called them economic royalists, said we're not going to allow our country to be run by bankers, right, and by people who are Tories. He called them economic Tories and royalists.
Well, Jerry, since the death of Franklin Roosevelt, this country has gone through, especially since the 60s, a very steep decline in understanding this. We have an email from Eugene Jaffe from Santa Barbara, California, who asks, partly what we've been discussing so far, is anybody in this country aware of this British-controlled system which is tyrannizing America besides the LaRouche movement?
Well, not in those terms of reference. I mean, because the reality of the situation is that people don't understand. There has been a 2,000-year battle, okay, that started in one sense with Babylon and the Babylonian takeover of the what was called the cult of Apollo at Delphi, which was a banking center. As part of the cult of Apollo, which you've heard about, they had a banking center. And the relationship between these oligarchical cults that run societies and banking is very precise, is very direct, and always has been so, right? Now, it's what I said in the beginning. You are not taught that history is not a series of moral stories. History doesn't work that way. It's a dynamic. It's a clash of two tendencies. One human, which is identified by Plato very early on, right? What it means to be human, what it means to be different than the animal, what it means to have a soul. This was explicitly rejected by Locke. Locke, who was the philosopher of the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, and I say that precisely. This is not a hyperbole or like something. He was the philosopher of the Anglo-Dutch system, said men had no souls. It was called the tabula rasa. And that therefore men were just talking beasts and could be used by other men who were more elevated, who had more power, right? This was, in a sense, he complained about Thomas Hobbes, who said that it was just survival of the fittest, which later became British philosophy, right? But in fact, since men were not human and had no soul, which was explicitly attacked by Gottfried Leibniz, who was actually one of the founders of the American system. Mm-hmm. This clash between life, liberty, property, which was literally the Constitution of South Carolina, which spread slavery throughout the United States, and the Declaration of Independence, which was life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that's not the happiness that most boomers think of, you know. It's the happiness of knowing that you are immortal and that your contributions to within your lifetime will last long after you are gone. And you can die with a smile on your face and said, I have done what history demanded of me, and the generation after me will be better because I lived.
Frank, I was just thinking, listening to what Jerry was saying about this question of the difference between man as animal as opposed to this idea of a soul, that this is actually where the impetus you get from music in inspiring in people something different, wouldn't you say, from your experience with the choral work in Boston?
Yeah, and it's very distinct. It's not as if it's unknowable, but you have an immediate reaction, which opens up it actually gets directly at the most human part of people. It's also something that a real scientist has while being part of a scientific investigation in terms of trying to figure out the nature in which the universe that they live in is actually organized and why any given system of government would be organized in that way at any given time. But we've been having a lot of fun with this thing specifically, especially around thinking about how do we organize this given area, the northeastern area, the congressmen and the senators in this area, to understand their intervention from this higher concept of defeating the Anglo-Dutch liberal system.
Well, you have in that area most of the congressmen, you know, Kerry, Kennedy. Kennedy's made some good statements, members of the House of Representatives in Massachusetts. But it gets to the first question second question I posed to Jerry. Is it enough just to be against these policies? And obviously that's where our work comes in, the work of the LaRouche Youth Movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the best thing whenever we've deployed the best is when we've deployed around challenging people around LaRouche's concepts, the concepts that LaRouche brings up in the paper, really understanding and fighting with this difference between the American system as a credit system, as a system based on creativity, and the Anglo-Dutch liberal system as a basically anti-human fascist system.
And it's explicit. You know, this Locke thing, people don't like to talk about it, right? But, you know, the Anglo-Dutch liberal system was slavery. I mean, it's not by accident. This was a slave system, as was Rome, as was the Venetians, a slave system, right? And with explicit denial, if you look at Locke, which Gottfried Leibniz wrote a 500-page refutation of Locke called New Essays on Human Understanding, in which he takes up explicitly the idea that not only is the soul knowable, right, but the idea that you have no soul is an absurdity, that human beings have no soul, that there's nothing immortal, there is no immortal part of human beings. This, on a very fundamental level, is what is being fought out here. Because what you have in the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, right, is a undead fondy. It's a hoard of money, right, into perpetuity. They have these what they call trusts, right, which later became these reinsurance companies and other things.
Actually, Jerry, I have just to take this right at the heart of the question. Then, what I'd like you to communicate to our listeners is why, therefore, this faction is a supports globalization, supports deregulation. Make that connection between the Lockean empire and today's globalized world of NAFTA and GATT.
Sure. Well, the core question between the clash of these two is that historically, this is not an abstraction, historically, from the time of Louis XI and the attempt at a French Commonwealth, and then in the very early 1500s, right, 1511 or so, right, and then you had late 470s, 480s, 490s, an attempt at an English Commonwealth.
Yeah, 1485. With
the overthrow of the Richard III, right. The form which humanity has taken in history was the form of a republic based upon the idea of the Commonwealth, right? That there is a general welfare, and that the purpose of nations, the purpose of political association, is to advance the general welfare of mankind. These have taken different forms, right? But the idea of the nation state has been that which has opposed the empires, right? This is not, we're not just saying this because we think nation states are nice or because America was a nation state. It happened along. The only way you can oppose this form of oligarchism is to create nations based upon a concept of the general welfare or the pursuit of happiness, right? That's the purpose of government. And therefore, the globalization is a global empire based upon looting of populations. That's not an abstraction. That, from Babylon to Rome to Byzantium to Venice to the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, has been based upon the ability to loot, and the nation state is based, as Dante Alighieri discussed it in De Monarchia and then later in De Vulgaria Eloquentia, which are two, and of course Nicholas of Cusa discussed this in a slightly different way, in a more profound way, right? That the idea of men and women coming together with a common history and a common language, expressing their own history in their own language, to say, how will we ennoble each of ourselves? And by ennobling each of ourselves, to allow a posterity for ourselves and our children, how will that inspire other nations of different language cultures, of different histories? But yet we are all commonly human. We all commonly in the image of God, and that we are the purpose of government. And our posterity is the purpose of government. We are not appendages to dead or undead Fondi. We are not. These are the undead.
Speaking of the undead, Stephanie, I know you've been organizing at the University of Houston, which until recently had something called the Enron School of Management in their business school. And Enron, I guess you could say, is not undead. Enron is dead. But does this idea of connecting the nation state with economic policy, is that something that you're having more success in communicating to students?
Not so much with finance and economics majors.
Yeah.
When you talk to them, there's a very disconnect between even many who admit there's a lot of problems, right? They've been to other countries like Mexico and stuff, and they see that free trade's destroying countries, and you ask, okay, well, what does government do? And then they just sort of draw a blank. So being able to discuss that is necessary, because otherwise, like, the ideas just aren't there. They're not being taught. They're not being discussed anywhere except, you know, at the LaRouche table on their campus.
Is there an awareness that something did happen on November 7th that changed things, that the current Congress is different?
Once you refresh people's memories, a lot of people have already started to move away from it. But generally, a lot of people are very excited.
Well, it seems to me, Jerry, that we've got a problem here of the gap between the potential that exists with this new politics and a new generation of leadership and the current Congress, which still, despite some positive signs, is showing that they may not be up for the fight. What's your sense of what it's going to take to get them into this in the proper way?
Well, you know, in a sense, these systems that I've been talking about have always collapsed. Because they defy the very laws of nature, because natural law is based upon the idea that men have souls and women have souls, and you apply these creative hypothesis-generating capabilities to solve fundamental problems, resource problems and related kinds of problems, right? And therefore, these systems collapse. And what you're dealing with now is something that the Congress cannot duck. If they could duck it, they would duck it. There's no question.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question in my mind that they would like not to deal with these problems, right? They can't quite duck the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Well, the president seems to be trying to.
Yeah, right. But I'm just saying, you that's not a problem.
Right.
So that what you have is a dynamic. That dynamic is in our direction. Because there's no way they can duck the collapse of their system. And this is not just the Depression. But this is a collapse. Very reminiscent of the collapse of Rome, very reminiscent of the collapse of the Venetian Empire, which led to the 1348-1350 Black Death. Which is not something you can duck, right? And the fact that we're on the scene, both in the country and in the Congress, that as this crisis deepens, and it will deepen, and they're soliciting Lynn's wisdom, they're soliciting Lynn's ideas. This pamphlet we've got out now is beautiful on the new economy and this what we've been discussing. Therefore, the dynamic of history, because these systems always lose. The Anglo-Dutch system, as of in the next 10 years, will not exist. The question is, will the American system replace it, or will you get chaos? Those are your choices. There's not a whole lot more.
And if you want to make your voice heard in this and live in real history, call us and get a copy or get multiple copies of this webcast pamphlet. Call us at 800-929-7566. And when you call, ask them how to make out a check to help this fight. Now, we've got a little bit more than 5 minutes. Frank or Stephanie, you have anything you want to ask Jerry? Frank?
Well, he just got directly at the question that I was going to ask. So LaRouche puts out something in the beginning of the Lost Art of the Capital budget paper, his latest paper, where he talks about our national goal. He said, you know, our national goal has to be a basis of physical wealth, the production of physical wealth. And he goes through it sort of in depth. But my question for Jerry was, you know, the only reason you understand that, and the only reason you would understand why you would need to deploy that type of economic activity from the federal government top down, is if you understood the type of effect it would have on the nation as a whole, in rejection to the British East India Company, and things like that. And yeah, I think you got at it a bit. You know the part I'm talking about?
Sure. There? Yeah. Yeah. And it also says very specifically in the paper, it's a question of when you reach a boundary condition. Because that's in philosophical terms, that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a boundary condition where it's a physical geometry. It's an interplay of physical geometry, right? And therefore, you cannot get beyond that boundary condition with the set of axioms that you presently have. You'll apply, as Lynn says, it's like trying to impregnate a plastic dummy. You might believe very profoundly that you could do it, but the more you apply the same axioms, the more disgusting the result.
It brings up an interesting question about the Cheneys, but I'll leave that alone.
Yeah, right. But the point is that you're at a boundary condition, and it's the end. You see, I don't think people really understand this. It's the end of the Anglo-Dutch system. What they did with the derivatives, what they've done with the real estate market, it's over. It's over. And the Congress, much as they'd love to duck it, you know, we don't have any illusions about it, because it's somewhat beyond their philosophical capabilities, right? They're going to have to step up to the plate, right? Because there's no way you're going to have anything left, right? If you do not face the reality of this crisis. And therefore, the crisis itself, the dynamic of history itself, is leading us to a very clear choice in this question. And the fact that we're on the scene, right, we have to keep our nerve and keep growing and keep pushing, right? Because the fact that we're on the scene under these kinds of crisis conditions is like when someone's on their knees and they turn to you and say, help me. Help me, right? And you say, I know what to do. Follow
Jerry,
me.
Jerry, I think this is important because I know that Mr. LaRouche expressed this himself in the last couple of days, that he's confident that this new generation of leadership coming up through the youth movement is rising to the task.
Absolutely. You know, what he said is very interesting. I had an occasion to speak to him on Tuesday night. And I said, you know, I'm very, very moved by this war room and what I see, the maturity of the group. Not just that group, but what I see, right? And he said, well, you know, it takes a couple of years to build a movement. It's not overnight, but I think we have it. And he said very specifically, they are now in a position, if they have the resources, to recruit in a way that they've never been able to do before. So Lynn was extremely optimistic, and he also referenced the work on the Kepler and the music as part of the growing maturity of the leadership qualities of the youth movement.
Well, what we've been trying to do on the LaRouche Show over the last year and a half is to bring each week a panel, and I'd like to thank Frank Mathis in Boston and Stephanie Nelson in Houston for joining us today, because it gives those of you listening to the show a chance to hear the voices of a younger generation, which ordinarily would be cast aside and say, wait your turn, play your video games, you'll have a chance at some point in the future. And this generation is not going to wait, because they've determined that the future depends on their activity now. Jerry, we're just about out of time, so let me thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure having you
on
here.
Oh, yeah, I enjoy it.
The cultural, philosophical, historical perspective is essential at this point. So this has been the LaRouche Show for January 20th, 2007. Join us again next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time.